Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT podcast. So today we're going to talk about fluids in sepsis. Now, you might have seen on the Twitter and on the podcast, on the blog site, I had this advertising push for a webinar I was doing with the New York State Partnership for Patients on Fluids and Sepsis. And we had some amazing folks like Manny Rivers, Dave Gajewski, Terry Klemmer, today's guest, Philippe Roba. And I tried to pack the panel with a variety of opinions, but due to some absences and for whatever reason, the message from the panel was not exactly the message I personally would push. And if you have any interest in listening, I actually have the link to the full panel. You could take a listen, and then maybe you'll see what I mean. But I wanted to not leave it there. I wanted to actually get Philippe back on the show and go a little deeper into the things that, if I was a panelist as opposed to the moderator, I might have been saying during the panel. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk with Philippe Roba on the topic of fluid and sepsis. He is an amazing intensivist from Canada. He has a particular interest in bedside ultrasound for critical care. He does a blog called Thinking Critical Care, which I have a few of the choice posts linked in the show notes for this episode at mcrit.org/175. Before we get to that, one big, big announcement for the blog. Now, you know, about, I don't know, a few months ago, Josh Farkas joined the MCRIT team. He brought PulmCRIT to link up to MCRIT, and it has been fantastic. If you're not reading the PulmCrit post, you do not know what you're missing. The posts have been insanely good. Well, we have another addition to the MCRIT family. My former resuscitation fellow, soon to start a shock trauma critical care fellowship, Rory Spiegel of EM Nerd, has linked up with MCRIT. And he is a self-described nihilist, very much an evidence-based practitioner, though that has changed somewhat as he's merged more into the resuscitation world, because you can't really have a fully evidence-based practice because maybe like 2 to 5% of what we do is evidence-based, and the rest really just needs to be based on clinical judgment and physiology. So we might see a title shift in EM Nerd. There might be more of a CC Nerd flavor, but regardless, it is now part of MCRIT. You will find it, again, just like PulmCRIT, as a separate but joined entity. So if you go to emnerd.com, you get all the EM Nerd posts. If you go to mcrit.org, they'll be mixed in with all the MCRIT stuff and PulmCRIT stuff, and I think it's a fantastic addition to the site. Okay, let's get to fluids in sepsis. So why don't you tell people who you are and what you do?
Okay. My name is Philippe Roba. I take care of sick people in this community hospital up in Montreal called Santa Cabrini Hospital. I've been the chief of service of the ICU there for a little more than a decade. And I'm an avid foam-ite or foam-er and really an ultrasound enthusiast. I've grown that since 2000, in the times when there wasn't any courses out there or anything teaching ultrasound. It was just a fluke that I happened to start up in a place where there was basically no cardiology department. They loved me because I helped out for call, and there happened to be an ultrasound machine sitting around, and I'd been around a few cases where, you know, the cardiologist when I was a resident just popped the probe on a patient and said, oh, this is tamponade, and said, well, that doesn't look like rocket science to me. There's a big black space around the heart and the heart's just squiggling around. It doesn't seem to me, you know, like you need a huge fellowship to at least tell that. And that's kind of what got me started. And also had a lucky elderly radiologist and sort of tail end of his career who was lonely in his corner and happy to come and help and happy to have some, you know, a young bozo come and ask him questions and ask him to double check stuff. So that's how I got started in ultrasound, and it really radically changed the way I practice. And it's not until the mid-2000s when some of this stuff started to come out, Yannick started to make his courses, and I actually felt like I was speaking to people who spoke the same language. And obviously now it's all over the place, and it's totally awesome to see how it's spread. And growing. And another decade or so, I don't think we're going to I don't think stethoscopes will really be used anymore. At least I hope not.
Indeed. Why don't you plug your blog at the same time as you discuss foam?
I blog at thinkingcriticalcare.com, and I try to I advertise it as trying to mix the evidence, the physiology, and the experience and the thinking process to try to come up with the best way to care for our patients, the sickest ones especially.
Absolutely. Now, you participated in a panel with Manny Rivers, Dave Gajewski. I was moderating, and we were talking about fluids and sepsis. I wanted to get the inside scoop on a lot of the questions we covered in a more condensed and perhaps open format. Are you okay with that, Philip?
Sure.
All right. So I guess the first question I have, especially keeping in mind your interests, is when you have a patient with suspected severe sepsis or septic shock, whatever the new definitions is having us call it today, what is your initial approach to examining that patient, both with a physical exam and an ultrasound?
It's all simultaneous to me. The ultrasound is part of the physical exam, so I'm generally starting as I'm walked over to the patient, and I'm assessing obviously his mental status just by talking a little bit, and at the same time I've got the probe in my favorite starting spot, which is subxiphoid area. So within just a few seconds, I'm going to eyeball his IVC, and I say that because I don't measure it 3 centimeters below the diaphragm in a diameter way. I don't think that makes any physiological sense. I look at the whole thing in the same way that we look at the whole LV to eyeball it. And I think we can extrapolate that if physicians can do that for an LV, you should be able to do that for an IVC and get an idea whether he's really empty, really full, or somewhere in the middle. And I don't think there's much point in, you know, measuring these couple percentage points of variability. I think that's when we get into that quagmire of small differences where there's no way to prove that 13% variation versus 10% variation is going to have much clinical significance, I don't think. So I try to group in grossly those 3 points. And at the same time, then I'm just going to look up and I'm going to take a look at the heart and see, you know, if I have any major ventricular dysfunctions, RV, LV, the RVL ratios. So all that takes like, you know, 15 seconds maybe to get a quick eyeball look at that and take a quick decision right there and then on volumes, pressors, both along with the vital signs, along with how the patient's mentating, how their belly feels, what their skin looks like. And to start, if I'm going to start heavier on fluids or start with pressors right away if the pressure's really low. If I've got a pressure in the 50s, I want to get some volume in quick. If they're really empty, let's say with us, and my pressure's really low, I might throw in 250 cc's of 3% saline because I know that's going to give a rapid volume expansion, and I'm not going to start squeezing with pressors with a totally, totally empty tank. If I'm going to give a bolus of ringers or whatever, it might take a while to get in. The albumin, it's going to take a while to come from the lab or from the blood bank in our case. So those things have delays and stuff. So I'm not against a little 15-minute quick pop. I only use one, generally speaking, one infusion of 3%, and then start some pressors early. If I see and they're looking more in the mid-range that they're somewhat, then I'll start with just infusing probably some crystalloid to start, maybe some albumin if I've got third space concerns, and start some vasopressors relatively early. If on the other hand, they're really full and have very little variation, if the heart doesn't have something like, you know, obviously an RV overload, which is implying a PE or something else, let's just say it's sepsis. And on the other hand, so the heart generally doesn't look so great, then as we spoke a little bit on the podcast there, I might start some inotropes with some vasopressors. I might start with maybe some epinephrine right off the bat, but I don't want to necessarily go into fluids in that particular patient's case.
Let's get really tactical on this.
All right.
So you come to that patient's room and you say you're going to look at the IVC. Are you doing it in transverse, longitudinal, both? What's your move?
Yep. Sorry about that. Yeah, I should have been more specific. I look at it in both. So I generally start off with the transverse and get an idea, and then right away I'm going to go into a short axis, and I'm going to try to look at essentially that whole segment between the diaphragm and just as it's sort of exiting the liver, and look at eyeball that whole segment there and get an idea whether it's, you know, small, medium, big, and how much variation it's got. And in the variation, I'm also going to look at the patient's respiratory effort, because that's, to me, that's huge. Like if I asked, you know, you or me to give a good sniff, we could probably collapse down our IVCs almost no matter what our true right atrial pressure is, because we can generate that much negative intrathoracic pressure. Your little old, you know, 90-year-old who's you know, breathing very, very with very little effort. You know what? The lack of variation or smallish variation doesn't necessarily mean that much in my mind.
Now, just from a critical care ultrasonographer standpoint, when you're ready to look at the heart, are you actually putting the patient left lateral recumbent to get the best possible view, or are you just doing them supine?
I'm just doing them supine. I mean, it's very rare. I mean, sometimes if there's some specific question I'm trying to look at, let's say the descending pulmonary artery and trying to see the split and can I see a clot or something, you know, like that. Yeah, then sometimes I might do it, but 95% of my views are done supine.
Okay. And now there's been some talk, and I haven't gotten into this mode yet, but you might. You're on the cutting edge of this stuff. Are you looking at the hepatic vein actual color Doppler? Can you explain what that's for, how to do that, and why that's a good idea?
I'm going to even give you the next level after that, which I haven't hit, but definitely look at the hepatic veins. I mean, they're very practical to see because sometimes, you know, you've got air, you've got gallstones, you've got something, so you might not be able to see your IVC always that well. Sometimes you've got a really obese patient, and even going through the liver and the lateral side, which usually bails you out from, you know, the subxiphoid issues, you might still not be able to see it well. Then I look for hepatic veins, and if the hepatic veins are not there, they're hard to see. Well, probably it's because the patient's really dry and you're struggling to see IVC because it's barely there. It's almost virtual. Sometimes you'll see these virtual IVCs that you really have to have a keen eye to look for, and you have to kind of look where it really is supposed to be to see that it's not there, let's say. On the other hand, sometimes you'll see these big, huge, dilated hepatic veins, and if you put flow on that, you'll see biphasic flow. Like, obviously, as you know, unless the patient has an inherent tricuspid regurg, you should have pretty much unidirectional venous flow in the hepatic veins. And when you're starting to see regurgitant flow, then you're getting into an area where you're going to get some congestion. It's pointing you to RV dysfunction of some etiology or another. And definitely those are patients in which I would be staying away from fluids.
Okay. And so that just basically means for people not utterly familiar with this stuff is you put it, your Doppler on, your color Doppler, and what you see is red, blue, red, blue, red, blue.
Yeah. Yeah. So let me tell you about this even newer stuff that I've just began to hear about. So one of my mentors, I'll say here, even though he was never technically an attending on me, is Dr. André Deneau. Now, this guy is an internist come anesthetist come critical care physician who has essentially wrote the entire textbook on perioperative transesophageal echo. If anyone reads it, he's one of the major authors. He has, like, I don't know how many hundreds of publications. I don't know how he stretches out these hours in his days. Kind of like you. I don't know how you guys do it. But nonetheless, he's now looking at portal vein flow, portal vein pulsatility, and really coming up with some amazing, you know, data that's in press. It's coming out sometime in the next few years. Just for everyone's sake, you spell his name Deneault. First name, André.
Thank you for that. I was going to ask you, say it like an American would say it.
Deneault, maybe? I'm not sure. But he's looking at that, and he's found that if you've got a 30% or more pulsatility of your portal vein, don't ask me exactly how he measures it. I haven't really done it yet. I've just been peeking at them. He's got like serious predictors of outcome on that and not doing well if you don't unload their RVs, even stuff that you wouldn't necessarily automatically equate, but it makes a lot of sense because this points to just venous congestion as a whole. But he looks at post-op delirium. He works as an anesthetist and ICU physician, so he kind of sometimes takes care of these patients the whole way, I guess. So if these patients in the OR have this or coming out, and they don't diurese them aggressively, they get, you know, they're longer to wean, they get post-op delirium, et cetera, et cetera. If he gets them down, able to diurese them well and get that good response, then they actually, like, have very little of that, which is kind of like, wow. But at the same time, you know, if we have an organ that's encased in a solid component that should be, you know, susceptible to congestion, it's the brain. But since it's not as hard outcomes, we don't have LFTs for the brains and stuff like that. So we don't clinically sort of notice it maybe as much. But a lot of interesting data is going to come out of that in the next few years.
So you've perfectly led us into our next topic of discussion, which is, and you have a huge basis in physiology. It's why I love reading your stuff. And you get your friend John-Emile Kenny on there as well. So it's like
a cheat.
Yeah, it's a double hit. We've been very blithe, I think, about saying, if you overwhelm them on fluid, the worst that'll happen is they'll wind up intubated. Most of the patients who that happens on probably should have been intubated anyway. No big deal. But it may be a big deal. And from a physiologic perspective, there's huge intimations that things don't work so well when your interstitium is full of fluid. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Actually, not that long ago, there was a study on some of their subsets of the FACT and the ARDSnet networks that I'd have to pull up the quote, and I'm sure you probably came across it, but that showed that the people who did the worst, if you gave them fluids, whereas the people who showed up a bit on the dryish side or the normal CVP side, if you gave those people fluid, even if you took it off after, you went into the restricted or the restrictive group, you didn't do as well as if you never gave it in the first place. So there's something just about the giving of the fluid. It's not just a sort of a simple plumbing and pressure issue. Well, I gave it, but now I take it out, so it's okay. But those people didn't do as well. The ones who got the fluids, who were kind of, you know, normalish, dryish in the first place. So I think that's a really key point, that the very fact of infusing significant amounts of crystalloids in a vascular space where nothing's ever meant to be infused, it's only supposed to come from your GI tract, any fluid that's in there, has a nocive effect in and of itself. And I think if you, you're familiar with the whole glycocalyx stuff and all that, I think that's fascinating stuff. I think obviously it's not, we don't have, lab tests that say, you've got high glycocalyx degradation products, so better back off of whatever you're doing or something like that. We don't have that yet, but it's going to come. And I think that's a huge, it's probably why fluid administration from an intravenous route isn't the greatest thing.
Yep, totally agree. So yesterday in the panel, we said, because in the States, you don't deal with this in Canada, but in the States, we're required currently to give 30 mLs per kg to every single patient with an elevated lactate or persistent hypotension. And the question was, is that okay? And I don't think the panel really addressed this to the level I really wanted to delve into. Most patients, when you think about it, that's a 70-kilogram man. That's 2 liters. I think in most patients, that's fine.
Absolutely.
But in some, I would prefer to be able to say, after my exam, that's far more extensive than anything the average folks are doing. We're using ultrasound. We're using a totality of things to evaluate. I want to be able to say, no, in this patient, 500 is where I'm stopping. And we can't do that right now. What's your take on that, Philip?
Yeah, that's really a shame because that's I think that's where people start seeing the difference between a guideline and a gold standard. And I think all these protocols, that's all they are, is guidelines. I don't think they're applicable to 100% to the one patient in front of you. That's my N=1 idea. And if you're designing a robot to treat thousands of people at a time, sure, that's what you should do because it's going to save most of the people. But there's going to be some that you drown in there. And I think, and they're rare. I think they're, it's less than 10%, probably less than 5%, who knows. But there's those people who come in and they've got, either due to their pre-existing cardiac function or due to their septic, myocardial dysfunction, they really are, I don't think, are volume tolerant. And I don't think they should be getting fluids. And I don't give, maintenance fluids anymore. I give fluids if I think they need fluids, and that's about it. But I do reassess all the time.
You've mentioned the term volume tolerant. And my thinking on this up until very recently has been, if you resuscitate with fluids up to the point of volume tolerance and then stop, that point can be discerned by seeing when the patient's volume responsive, meaning that they increase their stroke volume with that aliquot of fluid. And as long as you stopped at the point they stopped becoming volume responsive, you would easily be before the point where they're intolerant of volume. And you put out a post kind of turning that on its head. Could you speak towards that?
Well, yeah. And again, I'm saying this from someone who spent years flooding people because that's exactly what I would do. I'd go right to the point that they're no longer volume responsive. Then I have to just work with the other stuff, And then if you looked at all the data of, the VISEP or the VAS studies that showed that, in your upper quartile of fluid recipients, they did poorly. And those are not always like insane amounts of fluid. Sometimes they're just 5-6 liters in the first day. And that's not that uncommon, you know, in what I'd done and what I'd seen. And sometimes that still happens. So, and in discussing with a colleague who'd exactly that, who kind of equated volume responsiveness with volume tolerance, I was like, maybe it needs to be sort of distinguished. And actually, one of the people who came up with the Falls protocol, you know, one of the original grandfather of bedside ultrasound, Daniel Lichtenstein, who's a good friend of mine and mentor in the ultrasound sense for sure, that was one of his first things. He didn't really, in that sense, as soon as he saw the appearance of B-lines, he said, "Oh well, you know what? Like it's enough with volume." I might even be a little bit harsher than that and say, "Well, you're already." You know, you've already overstepped the tolerance if the B-lines have appeared. But obviously, that's certainly better than not looking, I think. So I think it's important to see that there's two points sliding along a scale. One is the volume responsiveness. One is the volume tolerance. And both will move because as your cardiac function changes, your responsiveness changes. As your leakiness changes, which is going to have to do with severity of illness, the time at which on your sort of illness pathway you've presented to the eMERGE or to you or I in the bed, that's going to be changing their level of leakiness, of volume tolerance, the progression of disease. Let's say I think the most important ones in sepsis is the lungs and the belly. If there's an intra-abdominal process and the belly's getting tight, you know, I'm going to measure intra-abdominal pressure and all that, but I also want to definitely back off on the fluids. So the measures for volume tolerance, sometimes I think maybe we could say if we start them off at an equipoint, as your cardiac function deteriorates, well, your volume responsiveness comes down and your volume tolerance may stay the same. But as your leakiness goes up, then you get less volume tolerant. So I think you really have to look at, I don't know if I'm explaining it well. It's easy to see on a
and we'll put it in the post that goes along with this. So
but basically I think you really have to assess both and make sure that if you're no longer volume tolerant, then forget about whether you're volume responsive or not, then you shouldn't give any more volume. And same vice versa. If you're not volume responsive, and you may still be volume tolerant, you know, your lungs are clear, you don't need much FiO2, your belly's fine, you may still be volume tolerant, but if you're no longer volume responsive, then what's the point? So I think whichever one you hit first is where you have to stop with your, you know, significant volume resuscitation.
And that brings us to the last point I want to discuss. And it's intriguing and difficult because volume responsiveness, we have some kludgy ways of measuring it, but it can be measured. Volume tolerance, on the other hand, for any organ except the lung, becomes very difficult. But you,
absolutely,
during your panel discussion, had some inroads into how we could start. Like the ideal, I think, would be we put a probe in the kidneys, we put a probe in the gut, and we put a probe in the brain. And then along with the ultrasound examination of the lungs, we'd have a pretty good idea of what the patient's doing. But we lack most of that. But you mentioned at least something to monitor the brain and how that integrates into your resuscitation. Can you talk about that, Philip?
It's so multifactorial, some of the stuff, what's going to impact it. I like to look at, and this again comes from André Denault, looking at cerebral oximetry, cerebral and somatic. This is originally a tool they use a lot in the OR, and I think started off mostly when they're looking at carotid surgeries and essentially assessing, is your circle of Willis okay? Is your saturation, lateralization of your oxygenation of the brain, is it going okay, let's say? And also was helpful to predict post-op neuro complications. But nonetheless, basically, you've got some electrodes that you put on the forehead, and it causes, similarly to your saturometer, causes a loop and looks at a mixture of venous and arterial blood. So it's analogous to your mixed venous or your central venous in terms of the physiology. It's a balance between extraction and between your output to the area, your perfusion to the area. So all things remaining more or less the same, is that if that saturation drops, is telling you that your perfusion is suboptimal. This being a mix again of venous and arterial blood, but predominantly venous. So the way that I like to use it mostly is to assess whether my interventions are having some positive effect on tissue perfusion. Whether I'm looking at over vasoconstriction with pressors? Have I reached sort of the descending limb where now my vasoconstriction, even if it's giving a nice pressure on the monitor, is actually impairing perfusion? Now, is that an endpoint in terms of fluid resuscitation? Hard to say. I think if I'd had signs of congestion and the sort of experience of André Deneau in looking at venous side congestion is that if you decongest, let's say your saturation has come down, but your pressures are up and your brain is congested, if you manage to decongest it with either, you know, RV reducing stuff or diuretics, your saturation may improve because now your cerebral perfusion pressure is better. Basically, fairly simple like that. Number one does have to keep in mind that it's regional as opposed to the global assessment that we look at in central venous pressure or mixed venous. That's a global mix. This is really regional. So you also have to make sure you're not dealing with if you've got trauma, edema, something that's specific to the area, you really have to take everything with that grain of, you have to assess it clinically globally.
Absolutely. Are you using any somatic markers?
Yeah, I usually put one on the thigh and one on the brain. That's my sort of baseline. And I don't think one can use values. We know that there's actually a wide distribution of quote-unquote normal. You know, most people sit between 60 and 80, but that's a very wide range. And I don't aim for a specific number because I don't know that the interventions required to getting me to a higher number are going to change the outcome at all. I don't really necessarily believe that. I've seen people in C8, who have just terribly chronically bad hearts. Like this lady had a cerebral sat of 15, good signal and all that. She was a little confused, but it's one of those patients who's had a bad EF for a long time. It's almost like barely moving, we're generous 10%, but the lady's actually fine. Like she's functional with this. So can I say that I have to bring a saturation up to 70? I don't think so. But I do want to know that whatever I'm doing, if it's fluids, I want to see it go up. Because I think if I've got no improvement, then what I'm doing, I'm not so sure. I might just be getting the bad side effects of it. Or the same thing with the vasopressors. I want to know that if I'm cranking up my MAP to 65 from 60 or 70 from 65, that I'm getting an increase and not a decrease of my tissue perfusion.
Absolutely. I guess the last point I'll make, and you could comment on it if you like, is... I think we're missing the boat in some ways on the durability of these fluid responsiveness markers, regardless of whether they're a flow marker like your cerebral oximetry or a point in time marker like a change in the patient's stroke volume, because it might very well be that a patient seems to be volume responsive. They increase their stroke volume after a bolus or a passive leg raise, but we have no indication that that's going to be a durable response. We have no indication that 20 minutes later they won't be exactly where they were prior to you hitting them with another 500 or 1,000 cc's. And this is my real trepidation about cardiac output measures and the whole idea of resuscitating to volume responsiveness is we know the fluid disappears. And the extent to which it disappears, I think, still remains a somewhat unanswered question. But we know it does not stick around to the same extent it does right after seeing a beautiful spike in your stroke volume.
Yeah, absolutely.
As opposed to something like a consistent infusion of inotropes or vasopressors, where if you see a positive response on your somatic markers, your brain markers, you could have some degree of reliance that at least for an hour or two, unless something changes radically the physiology of your patient, that's going to continue.
Well, that's a nice thing also about using continuous measurements, whether you're looking at continuous cardiac output measurements or whether you're looking at tissue saturation measurements, you've got something that's always telling you something. Or, hey, all of a sudden, things have been, nurses would call me with that now that they're used to it. They say, his cerebral sat's been trending downwards in the last hour. I'm like, oops, let me go take another look. And it may be that, basically the fluid that I gave him or whatever, it's all gone. So you can't just park it, write your orders and walk away until like late after, 5, 6, 8 hours later. That's just not, it's an intensive care unit, so you should be reassessing frequently. And that means the ultrasound probe stays there and the your monitors should be monitoring for trends. I think that's a really key thing as opposed to absolute values.
Absolutely. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and for doing the panel, Phil.
Oh, no problem. I can't thank you enough for inviting me to the show and then to the panel. It's like a complete honor.
Well, there you go. Scott Weingart for the MCRIP podcast saying bye-bye.